Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, Bluegrass, American Roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning, welcome to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. We're here every Saturday morning 11 till 12 talking about science in all its different forms. You've got Julian Pauly live in the studio. We'll be talking to RPG shortly, and also we've got our guest speaker this week, and indeed every third Saturday of the month it's Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society. He'll be talking about colour theory. Amazing. First up, science news this week then.
Right, here we go. Scientists have blamed a triple whammy of climate chaos for rapid ice melting in Antarctica, which neared record highs last year. The study, published in Science Advances, cited a combination of deep ocean heat, strong winds, and the self-reinforcing feedback cycle.
Meanwhile, European countries are being urged to follow Spain in installing more climate shelters as heat deaths continue to rise. Last year, the Spanish government announced a national network of shelters building on existing regional schemes in response to increasingly intense heat waves.
And a powerful Super El Nino weather pattern is also set to drive up temperatures further around the world in the coming months, and will probably make 2027 the hottest on record. El Nino occurs about three times a decade, raising global temperatures from one autumn into the following summer, and is caused by the release of heat from the Pacific Ocean.
And I suppose a bit closer to home, perhaps. Wind and solar electricity generation in the UK has saved approximately £1.7 billion in gas imports since the start of the Iran war. Analysis by Carbon Brief shows that wind and solar power have generated a record 21 terawatt hours since the end of February.
I see I've got a really big
word. I'm going to try and help you with this, Paul.
I've just looked at it.
It's nearly
full alphabet. Anyway, thousands of patients suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome are to have their full genetic codes mapped in an attempt to find a cure for the debilitating and mysterious illness. The study, a world first for the syndrome also known as
myalgic encephalomyelitis, or ME for short, that's why people call it ME, I think,
will be funded by an investment of $4.75 million from the government in the hope that it will lead to a test to reliably identify the illness and eventually develop drugs to treat it for the first time.
And next up is a little story, a little snippet from our Chris, who actually will be our guest speaker next Saturday, and indeed every fourth Saturday of the month, and he'll be covering this story, I think, in more detail. So, a sandwich from upmarket bakery Gales has more salt than nearly five McDonald's cheeseburgers or 10 rashers of bacon. Its smoked chicken Caesar Club contains almost 7 grams of salt, which is more than the limit of 6 grams of salt that adults are recommended to stick to in one day. Too much salt leads to high blood pressure, which is known as a silent killer, as it raises the risk of heart attacks and stroke. Action on Salt and Sugar, based at Queen Mary University of London, analysed 546 sandwiches, with more than 1 in 10 of them exceeding government salt targets, and 44% of them that they analysed would have to carry a red warning label on the packet due to their salt content. The campaign group said high levels of salt were not inevitable, comparing a Pret a Manger chicken sandwich that contained 2.22 grams of salt with a similar one from Greggs that only had 1.1 grams, so it is doable. So there's other supermarkets who do the lower salt content as well. So Action on Sugar and Salt are basically urging consumers to check the label and look for a sandwich with less salt and saturated fat,
always
ideally with lean
label.
Protein and more fiber. Of course, you could always make your own sandwiches, even better for you, because they know what's going into them. And before we speak to RPG, I'm just going to talk about an article on brain health that I saw recently. Fascinating. First one, important thing for your brain, exercise regularly. If you do only one thing for your brain, move your body every day. Even brisk walking increases blood flow and stimulates powerful growth factors, proteins that help new neurons to grow and form connections. Regular aerobic exercise has been shown to increase the size of the hippocampus, which is the brain's memory center. Movement is the most powerful tool we have to build brain resilience. Another one for your brain is to get enough sleep. It's crucial to sleep 7 to 8 hours a night. During deep sleep, the brain activates its natural clearance system, removing metabolic waste products, including proteins linked to Alzheimer's. Sleep also consolidates memory and restores attention. Even a week of short sleep can impair focus and learning. Long-term sleep deprivation, or sleep apnea, is associated with profound shrinkage in the brain. Another one is eat properly. What you eat every day directly influences your brain's vitality and level of performance. Adopting a Mediterranean-style diet rich in leafy greens, berries, olive oil, nuts, beans and fish will reduce inflammation and oxidative stress, two processes that damage brain cells over time. Healthy fats, particularly omega-3 fatty acids, are critical brain vitamins and support neuronal membranes, while antioxidants help protect against cellular injury. Another one, probably a bit obvious, I guess, reduce your stress levels. Keeping calm can make your brain bigger. Practice slow breathing daily. Spend 5 minutes practicing slow, controlled breathing while focusing on the flow of air in your nostrils. It's a simple habit that will help you calm the stress response, lower cortisol levels, and improve emotional regulation. Chronic stress is linked to a reduced hippocampus, while relaxation practices expand its volume. As I said earlier, the hippocampus is a part of the brain. It's its memory center. And finally, train your brain. Challenge your brain the right way with activities that are new, fun and engaging. Learning a language, practicing a musical instrument or taking up dancing pushes the brain to build new pathways, unlike passive activities such as endless scrolling, which offer limited cognitive stimulation. The goal is not just to stay busy, but to stretch your mind in ways that demand attention, memory, and flexibility. So five key things there to look after your brain: exercise regularly, get enough sleep, eat properly, reduce your stress levels, and train your brain with interesting things.
Yeah.
cracker of a track there from a band called Kitchen Lover. There Goes My Brains. And that was one of our PG's pick for Glory Days last year. And you are, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 yes. FM. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning. It's a lovely day, isn't it?
It is, and we actually brought you in on a beautiful track there, which we'll be playing later.
Yeah.
All good stuff. What's caught your eye in the science news this week, then, Paul?
A couple of things. One of the things is a bit of a worry starting to build up about the number of space launches that are being made. And there's been a massive increase in the number of launches for things like putting satellite galaxies up into the sky for high-speed broadband connections, amongst other things. But what's happening is we're fighting to maintain our sort of atmosphere down on Earth, but in the upper atmosphere, there's starting to build up some smoke from the rocket launches. And it can be a smoke that's got some sort of nasty chemicals in that can affect the atmosphere, perhaps generate more CO2 and start to contribute to climate change even. So a bit of a worrying side effect of so many rocket launches to put things into space. Other than that, I don't know if you guys picked up on the thing about bathing sites.
Oh, we did. We did.
Yeah. And basically, I think they've identified 14 bathing sites where they will test for water quality. But the initial tests on the 14 sites mean that there's only one of those sites is graded good for swimming. And one is graded satisfactory. The other 12 are not. So what they're saying is that it's a solution of both animal and human fecal matter that seems to be the big pollutant that is making them put up warning signs. So when you go to one of these spots, there'll be a notice which gives you the status and say they'll be tested regularly to see if they improve. But I think they've identified one of the first on the upper reaches of the Thames. So something to be watched for. But again, it's just an indication of the condition of our waterways. And I thought I'd go, one of my favourite sort of hobby horses is just how much we need our water supplies and what that means to us. So water is basically listed quite widely as H2O. So that means there's two hydrogen atoms bonded to one oxygen atom. It's inorganic. It's an inorganic compound. And it's transparent, tasteless, odourless, and nearly colourless, although sometimes you can pick up a colour hue in it. But it's the main thing in all of the Earth's streams, lakes, oceans, and the fluids in all living organisms. So we human beings are generally made up of somewhere between 50% and 75% water. So when you climb on the scales, when you're trying to lose some weight...
Ooh, that's it.
Yeah, be good if you get a tap on the ankle, I think, is it? But... Oh, dear. Yeah, sorry about that. I couldn't help it. But water is also known as a solvent and often called the... A universal solvent, as it can actually make a lot of changes. I think that water in itself doesn't really provide food energy. So we're not getting calorific content from it, which is why it's a good thing to make sure, again, most of the recommendations are making sure you get up to a couple of litres of water a day that you drink. And when you talked about brain health, it's one of the things that can help.
Yeah.
Rid the body of pollutants and improve your brain health.
And it's good for your skin. You are what you know, your skin needs water. As you said, we are 50 to 75% water. And if you drink water, it's got no sugar in it, no salt, no E numbers, like a lot of these fizzy drinks and things.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's an incredible sort of thing. It is inherently a part of humanity. It covers about 70-odd percent of the Earth's surface in the form of the seas and oceans, making up most of that sort of volume. I mean, that's sort of in the upper 90s percentage of water volume on Earth. And some water, we've talked about groundwater before, which is only about 1.7%, but again, we've spoken about it being under pressure. I think a lot of places where the surface is drying out, they're boring into the infrastructure below that to tap into groundwater, and that's making massive differences. And I think that humanity is also intervening in the rivers. There's currently a massive dam project underway in China, which predictions say will be a heavy enough body of water to change the orbit characteristics of the Earth and the spin characteristics. So it's integral. We sit amongst it, and the current moonshots in some extent are about finding potentially water on the moon. Because it's such a springboard for life, and also some of the other operations to go further into space. Again, the surveys are going on with Mars, which we're told is one of the life goals from Elon Musk at the moment, to put people on Mars. And they've identified a massive valley on the Martian surface, which they say was originally created by water movement. So they're really trying to nail down whether water has gone from those two sort of planetary bodies. But there's a reality touching the world as well. We continuously let water vapor escape out into space as a planet. So there is a kind of a movement of water in that extent. And I don't think that, other than saying it's dispersed and diffused into space, there's not really a tracking system to say where that water vapor has gone, whether it collects, whether it just disappears. You know, there's no real sort of handle on where it goes, but we do know that there is a loss of water. Also, we got big news from the Arctic and the Antarctic about the breakdown of the ice caps, starting with big ice falls, and that again will change the water, because water can really consist of a vapor. And it can also be a liquid, and it's can condensation, precipitation, runoff, and transpiration. That's part of the water cycle from evaporation. So it's incredible. You know, in terms of the world's economy, about 70% of fresh water is used by humans goes into agriculture and growing our food. Fishing in salt and freshwater bodies continues as a major source of food and provides something like 6.5% of global protein. And there's a lot of research going on now with things like seaweed, to see whether we can farm seaweed. That's also got a side effect of trapping carbon. So are, they can be grown for food, as a food resource, but also as a store of trapping carbon and keeping our atmosphere breathable. So, pretty good thing for it. And apart from that, as human beings, we talked about swimming, but we enjoy going out on boats, surfing, sport fishing, diving, ice skating, snowboarding, skiing. Our word water comes from an old English "water," which is an early Germanic language, and also using an old Saxon word, which is very similar, "watar."
Watar.
Yeah. So it's kind of a, you know, one of those things that we rely on so much. We don't always sort of value it, I think, because it is there. You know, I mean, for a lot of us in the developed world, it's just the turn of a tap. And going back to the start of the swimming and pollution, again, one of the problems that's happening now, and I was trying to find out if there's actually a measure of allowable amounts of microplastic in water supplies. I'm not finding that at the moment. Possibly it's there and I'm just not finding it. But it's one of those increasing worries that we're ingesting plastics via something like our drinking water, or we're actually disseminating plastics via things like our washing machines, pumping microplastics out into the world. So there are some moves. We talked about a chap who has developed a washing machine with a filter system to remove microplastics. And I noticed recently there's someone touting a bag system where you put your washing into a bag before you put it in your washing machine, and that will trap the microplastics, allegedly. I don't have the proof of that one. But it's amazing how that kind of movement is developing with water. And because the world population's increasing, the demand on water's increasing. So a lot of things happening in the geopolitical world, and say that there are worries about dams on the Nile. It's one of the longest river stretches in Africa. And so many countries from the source to the sea make use of the waters of the Nile. If someone further up close to the source decides to restrict it, then it can impact on several countries. So it's one of those resources that I feel we've got to keep free. It's okay to have great high-flung ideas, but if we're generating power by trapping water to generate electricity, are we actually impacting on the system that supplies us with our drinking water, irrigates our land and other things? So it's amazing just how much interwoven we are with H2O.
Well, I think I read somewhere, this ages ago, about you can't survive for more than 3 days without water. I think that's about right. Is it 3 minutes without breathing?
It's
something like that. It's the threes, I think. It's like 3 minutes without breathing, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food.
Yeah.
And something like that.
It is, yeah. No, I think it's a rule of thumb guide is that, and it's quite right. I mean, I think you can challenge it because I was reading a couple of weeks ago about somebody increasing the free diving record for holding your breath while swimming down in the ocean, and that's gone way past 3 minutes.
Yeah. But you'd have to be super fit and super trained to do that. We knew somebody who could do that, actually. I can't remember the length he could hold his breath for, but you think, wow.
Yeah, Well, I think 5, 6, 7 minutes is quite good, but I think it's gone way beyond that. Again, you know, you think, well, yeah, we're going to try and explore places we've got to see. And quite often we say that the depths of the ocean are as unknown as the outer reaches of space. Increasingly, we are investigating. We've talked about mineral mining on the deep sea floor, where they find clusters of minerals that the mining industry is looking to vacuum cleaner off the ocean floors. But again, I think the problem is to achieve one end, which is in that instance, they're after the minerals used in high tech. But to upset the balance of the system that supplies drinking water for the sake of our mobile phones is maybe not the smartest use of the things that are around. But obviously, as the world develops around, people become aware of things. I mean, it's a nice little exercise. I think we're seeing it happen now in schools to take away your high-tech mobile phone and to survive without it and communicate without it and talk it to people a bit more. Because I think once you get involved in it, then human ingenuity has developed the apps, the algorithms that make it quite addictive. And the problem is, when they start to monetize that, people start to become a commodity. So, again, that's another thing that's around in the world at the moment is the balance between, and we've seen Australia now banning smartphones for under 16s. And that's, as I think people predicted, has got a reasonably positive effect, but can be quite cheated because a lot of the time the kids are more savvy than parents and people trying to control them.
It's always the way. Fantastic, Paul. And we're going to play out with your choice of track because you've talked mainly about water.
I think so, and I think the world's a uncalm thing, so a bridge over troubled water.
Indeed, by Simon and Garfunkel. Fantastic. Great stuff, Paul.
Thank
and
you, Paul.
We shall speak to you Monday. Glory Days Rock Show, 1, 2, 3. Hurrah.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Bye. Bye, guys.
Fall so hard, I will. Sail on, silver girl. Sail on by. Your time has come to shine. All your dreams are on their way. See how they shine.
Bit of a classic track there, Bridge Over Troubled Water by yes. Simon and Garfunkel, because RPG was talking about the importance of water and take it for granted at our peril, basically. Of course, listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 until 12. We should have Gareth Morgan on the line. Good morning, Gareth.
Good morning.
It seems ages, because we missed last month, didn't we?
We did, yeah. It's been a while.
It has indeed. So for people who don't know who you are, Gareth, you're a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society.
That's right, yeah.
I know, and it seems the club, as always, is going from strength to strength. And what I see on social media anyway, you're everywhere, not just you, but your fellow members.
Yeah, well, it's that time of the year. I think start of summer we have the whole Yorkshire competitions, and then that goes on to the nationals. So it's a busy time.
So have you as a club done pretty well this year then?
Yeah, we've done okay. So we're in the final of one of the trophies, and I think a few of our images are representing Yorkshire in the nationals.
Wow.
Including one of mine, I'm not boasting.
Oh, which one is it?
It's a funny one. It's a photograph of a nun drinking a glass of whiskey. But
so what? Yeah, different categories, obviously. But
it's a portrait shop.
It's a portrait.
It was a bit of a jokey shot. We set
but
up,
you never know what the judges are going to like, do you?
Well, it's a funny one. I think it stood out because it wasn't serious, and there were lots of very serious portraits, and there was this funny one of a nun in full habit with a cigar and a glass of whiskey.
I like it. So this month you're going to talk to us about colour theory.
Yes, well, I thought, it's a slightly difficult topic to get over on the radio because it's very visual. But if you think about, I'm sure people are familiar with the concept of the colour wheel.
Yes.
So it's like, think about a rainbow, but, you know, going round into a complete wheel. So you've got all the, you know, the Richard of York stuff. So you go, the way you tend to visualise it in photography is you have yellow at the top, blue at the bottom, red off to the right-hand side and green to the left. And then every hue of those, you know, all the different shades within that circle follow that kind of spiral. And it's used a lot, obviously, in colour photography in two ways, really, to kind of inform your plans for photography, but then also in the after the event in processing to maybe change certain elements to make it look more harmonious, let's put it that way, and pleasing to the eye. There's a whole scientific basis to colour theory about the psychology of colour and how people's vision interacts with it and what's appealing and what's not. And, you know, you can see some colours together and they obviously work, but others tend to jar. And it's the ones that jar you have to avoid, unless you're deliberately setting out to kind of create a shocking image or something like that.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
So it's I think if you keep that side of that idea of the rainbow in your mind when we go through it, traditionally, colour was created, obviously, from the three primary colours, red, yellow and blue. And if you think about all the classic artists, you know, going back to Da Vinci and even earlier, they would mix from red, yellow and blue to get every other colour that they used.
Yeah, which is quite astonishing. Particularly when you're a child and you're learning that, you think, hey?
I know, it just, and it, it still freaks me out when you think about the millions of hues that you can get. And then, I mean, in photography, it's slightly different because we use, you may see on your, when you're processing stuff, that it says sRGB or Adobe RGB or Pro RGB. RGB is for red, green, blue. And yeah, that's the color that camera sensors pick up primarily and then mix together to do the same effect. Why they use green instead of yellow, it has been explained to me, but I don't think I could explain.
I was going to ask that because when you describe that wheel and you got yellow at the top of the wheel, which I thought was interesting, when you said it's circle, you imagine the circle.
Yes.
You'd have the yellow at the top, the blue at the bottom, the red on the right, and the green on the left. I would have expected the red to be, you know, because it's red, yellow, blue, but I don't know. That's
I think it was based originally on, you know, like the idea of a clock face.
Yeah, so
you're starting at 12 o'clock. As you go around, the first colour you hit is red. And yellow is actually the last, but it ends up at the top because you're at number one is red.
Yes,
It's a lighter shade of red, and then you go round two and three, get deeper red, and then you go to the oranges, and you know around to the blues, and then you come up again greens to yellow. So it's I mean it doesn't really matter where you what shape. It's as long as you think about. The relationship to each other is what's important.
Whether they contrast or whether they complement or...
Exactly. And I mean, the way it's used then is you can use it to bring a subject forward. So you think about, you know, a red balloon in a blue sky. It stands out. Or, you know, Little Red Riding Hood in a snowy forest. That red cloak stands out against that background. In other cases, they kind of harmonize, you know, a Caribbean beach with a blue sky and a yellow sand. They kind of fit together quite nicely. But if you get slightly the wrong hue, it can look very funny. It can look wrong.
Yeah.
And you even see that in nature shots. Sometimes people kind of overprocess. They take a landscape or an animal in a forest and they overprocess it. So you get like neon greens. And that just doesn't work. You have to get natural colours. And that's where colour toning and colour theory comes into it. And I mean, you can use it to harmonise a picture as well as pulling things out. You can use it to push things back in if you want to kind of have a more even spread of colours. It's also very useful for kind of conveying emotions and feelings because... You know, a bright red has a strong, it's a much more emotive colour than, if you like, blue, which is seen as a cooler, more resting, calm type of colour.
I do like, I'm always attracted to blue. I find it a very nice colour to look at. Even in a garden, I'll go always be drawn to blue.
Yeah, it's funny how people do have favourite colours, and it's all about the way your perception developed in the early days and what you found pleasing to look at.
Mm.
It's, I mean, I'll not get too deep into the philosophy at all, but it's, but you can do that. So if you use the warmer ones, red, orange, yellow, they will bring a subject towards you. They'll make it stand out from the background. It kind of demands attention and it gives you that kind of high energy feel. Whereas blues and greens and maybe purples and some of the other colours tend to make the thing recede and blend a bit more in the background. It's much more calming and tranquil sort of feeling. So it probably says something about your approach to life, really. Yeah. Tranquil and calm.
I try to be. I try.
Describes you to a T. I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know. I was very much into in the 80s, very much into really bright colours. But as I've got older, I'm much more reserved in colours now. Maybe it's an age thing. So, you know... It's interesting because I know you do like black and white photography.
Well, yes.
But colour, actually, there's lots of shades of black and white, isn't there?
Well, I mean, actually, there's as many shades between black and white.
Yes.
You think of the shades of grey. And it's one of my bugbears, I'm wandering off the tack now, about black and white photography. You need to have black and white in there. It's not grey. And I see so many monochrome images, let's call it, instead of black and white, where it's everything's too grey. You have to have strong blacks and strong whites to make the photographs work, I think. Anyway, that's
which is obviously why you're winning or getting lots of awards for your black and white stuff.
Well, it's interesting because one of the photographs I won a competition with in a sort of local one was a print I'd done, and I wasn't happy with it because it was too, it just wasn't enough contrast. And I put that in the Yorkshire one, it did absolutely nothing. It scored a 9, I think, and that was pathetic. I reprinted it. And I beefed up the contrast, so it was a darker black and a brighter white. And damn me, it won the whole competition.
Well, it's interesting because you talk about colour theory, but actually black and white are colours as well, aren't they, in their own sense? Yeah.
I mean, in one sense, they are the absence of colour.
Yes.
I won't get into.
Yeah, but it makes you think about colour, doesn't it?
It does, and it makes you think about, even within colour theory, it's about hues and tones. So, you know, you think blue, but how many different blues are there?
A lot.
FA Cup final this afternoon, you've got Manchester City playing Chelsea. They both wear blue kits, but they're very different.
Yeah.
Ooh. You know, so wandering off at a tangent again, but these things tend to happen. So I think, just getting back to the photography side of things, there are a few approaches that we take as photographers. And you're either looking for colours that fit our approach, or if, you know, like I do often, I work in a studio setting, it's totally in my control. So I kind of curate the colours to deliver what it is I'm looking for. And you can look for various types of harmonies. So complementary would be where you're using two main colours and they sit opposite each other on the colour wheel.
Yeah.
So, you know, you'd have blue and yellow, maybe reds and greens, maybe orange and teal. That's currently this kind of one of my favourite combinations. It's really green and a kind of reddy yellow, but it's particularly.
I've always liked red and green. Some people, my grandma would have said red and green should never be seen, I think. But I like that contrast.
No, it works, and they are anything that's opposite each other on the wheel will be complementary. You then got what's called analogous, and that's why you may have 2, 3, 4 colours that sit next to each other on the wheel. So think about a forest in autumn. You've got lots of shades of oranges and rust and red and browns, and they're all, you know, in that same quadrant of the wheel.
Yeah.
But they work together. They fit and match each other. And that's quite nice. You can actually take a monochromatic approach to colour. So we were talking about monochrome, black and white. But I've seen some absolutely beautiful pictures that they're blue, but they're shades of blue.
Yes, yeah.
And you get it, so you get a whole range from very light blue to dark navy blue. And that can work kind of quite well. And then the one that I find quite tricky is what's called the triad. And that's about including the three primary colours.
Oh.
But it's quite hard to match. So you'd have like three colours together. And typically it's kind of a street scene where you're trying to perhaps get a bit of red, a bit of yellow, and a bit of blue in there. And they are quite hard to manage. You can go over the top a little bit. But if you get it right, it's quite vibrant and bright, and it works quite well. If you go a little bit too far, it becomes a jumble, so it's all about control.
I guess it's too hard for your eye to absorb it all if it's too much of the primary colours.
There's one of those photographic rules, which I always say, we call them rules, but they're not rules because they're there to be broken. But it's called the 60-30-10 distribution rule. And it's about trying to ensure that when you've got lots of colours, you don't end up with a chaotic mess. So you try to use colour theory to bring the palettes closer together. You'd have 60% of your kind of main dominant tone, if you like, which is usually when I do it, I look for something a bit cool, a bit more natural. Then your secondary tone, 30% of that, would be something that really stands out a bit more. adds a bit of structure and a bit of depth. And then 10% you save for what's called the accent. And that might be, as I said before, the kind of red balloon in a blue sky, where you've got something quite small in the picture, but it's carrying a lot of the colour.
Ah,
and it pops out because you're doing that.
So would you be thinking about this when you, if you're controlling the shoot and you've got some control over the setting, would you be thinking about this before you go in, or would you be also doing it post your photography using processing?
I do a bit of both. I mean, when I do a shoot in a studio, I often do what's called a mood board, which I'll share with the model, because it's just a few ideas of kind of colours and looks that I'm going for. And then you can choose things like, the studio I use in Sheffield has probably 20 different backgrounds that you can use for colour. But even if you've only got a white background, you can change it by putting a coloured light on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then, I think about that, toning it together. I think about the costumes that people are going to wear, maybe what other props we're going to use. And if I can, the more you get right at the start, the less you have to worry about in post-processing. But then when you get to the end, if you find you've put together, a really nice scene with lots of warm colours, and in one corner you've got this jarring bright blue something or other, you can change it in post-processing. That's the great thing about digital
photography.
you can go in and
erase it or change
I mean, you can do some of it as you go. You can change things. So in your camera, you've got a thing called white balance, in the old days it used to be called colour balance, but now on most cameras it's called white balance, and I always recommend people set it on average, because then, it will cover most circumstances. But there's all sorts of things in there, like flash balance, cloudy day, bright, all sorts of subjects. Even things for balancing the camera, for if you're under tungsten lights, because they will give you a kind of green tinge to everything. Whereas if you set your colour balance right, it takes that out. So you can do things with your camera controls. And one of the things I like to do sometimes is to put an obviously wrong setting and see what happens, because you get some weird and wonderful results.
Accidents can happen, can't they?
Well, you just it's experiment. And you can always do it one with, one without, and see what happens.
Yeah, amazing.
You can add in things like, obviously planning the wardrobe, but you can use gels on lights, which is just little coloured sheets, to bring colour into the scene that you want. If you haven't done that, just use Photoshop after the event, and you can do a lot of different things with it.
You can change it to within. Talking about, you're saying you're back at the studio. Do you want to tell us about, because you always use a Sheffield studio, I think it's called Zavod.
Yes.
And they were closed temporarily. I think the owner was pregnant, was she?
Yes, yes.
And then you're back, are you?
The studio's back up and running. It's in Attercliffe, Stevenson Road, I think. It's in an old factory. Zavod is the Russian word for factory.
Oh, is it?
And the owner likes, the owner is called Zenya, and she is Russian, but speaks perfect English, likes that sort of industrial setting.
Yeah,
but
you
can create, the great thing about studio setup is you can make an old, it's an office setup in an old studio. It's really in an old factory, but it's a really large space. You can make it look like a New York loft, a bedroom, whatever you want, just by clever use of props and a bit of lighting. Or you can leave it. I like shooting it a bit grungy sometimes.
As an industrial space.
Yeah.
So it's very really Sheffield. Good. Very Sheffield. And obviously, Attercliffe's very up and coming as well, isn't it at the minute?
Yeah, it's the place to be at the moment.
Blimey.
So well worth a visit if people are interested. If you want to get some photographs taken, she's a very good photographer as well, so... have a look on the internet. You'll find Zavod there. It's quite good.
Right. Any more tips on colour theory?
The one last thing I was going to mention is a little bit of software that I use called Paleton.
That's clever, isn't it? Paleton.
Yeah, it is. The beauty of it is it's free. So power
yeah, everybody likes that word yeah, free on free. Apps and things.
And it's actually designed for designers, for people who use colour for, you know, decoration, houses, all sorts of things. Any sort of designer can use it. But what it does is it helps you build kind of harmonious colour palettes by maybe picking a main colour, and then it has effectively a colour wheel built into it. And you just, you know, put your arrow on the colour you want to start with, and it'll give you 2, 3, 4 other colours that would harmonise with that or contrast with it, or all sorts of other things. So I would use that. You have to be slightly careful with it because it's designed for designers and painters. It's based on the red, yellow, blue rather than red, green, blue setup. But the principle's the same, and it still gives you pretty close approximation to what you need.
Is that where you came up with your orange and teal combination, or was that just by chance?
It's by chance. I think it's one I've used. And a lot of this, actually, people know intuitively. I mean, we've kind of tried to make it a bit scientific. Oh, I've tried to make it a bit scientific today. But you know that these colours together. You look at it and it feels right. And I just, some time ago, found that combination to be pleasing. The great thing is using Palatón, it confirms it, and it tells you what shade of teal and what shade of orange works best together. Because a bright orange with a soft teal doesn't work. You need kind of pastely shades.
Yeah, you need a balance.
Yeah,
don't you? Yeah. So, you know, in the photography world, then, I mean, people still do black and white or monochrome.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you know, do you see trends in the colours that people use? Much as that fashion changes and bright yellows in and then it's out and pinks in and then it's out. And do you see that in the photography world in competitions?
To a slight extent, although the one thing that, because of the way particularly modern cameras are designed, red is always, and always has been, the primary accent colour that photographers will look for.
Yeah, because it really grabs
attention. A number of times you will see
attention.
You know, somebody in a red, you might see a girl in a red dress, you might see a red flower and a green background. But photographers are always looking, red is the accent colour of choice. And that's never changed, well, since I've been doing colour photography. You know,
because it's the most powerful, eye-catching, I guess.
Yeah, I think, and it pops. Others, you know, others will do the same effect, but you get a good red with a good background, it really stands out.
But there's so many reds.
Well, that's true.
I think red's a very, very difficult colour.
Yeah.
Difficult in terms of skin tone and everything to get perfect
with my
red.
Background, I always say telephone box red is the one to go for.
Is it?
Yes. But then I used to work for a well-known phone company.
No, I just think red's
I was in charge of telephone boxes for a while. But anyway, that's another story.
Is it technically paint box red there? Red?
It is called, I think it's called, well, there's pillar box red, which is it's the old, because obviously post telecoms was together at one time under the post office. So it's pillar box red, I think it's called.
Wow, we're going to Google that now. It'll have to be a nail colour, I'm sure, like Chanel or someone will do
that.
Well, I think that's been fantastic talk. It does make you think about colour. And for me, when you said orange and teal, for some reason I started to think about purple in that combination.
Yes, and it does go with it. Purple, I find, quite a difficult colour to handle.
Yeah.
It's, purple and yellow goes quite well together. I've got some shots of that, which doesn't feel quite right, but it did work quite nicely.
Yeah, well, I should be looking what comes up on Facebook and all your other social media accounts to see what colours you're using.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Okay.
Brilliant stuff, Gareth, as always. I'm sure you could have tied music into that and album covers like Deep Purple and Deepest Purple.
Yeah.
We could have gone down that route as well. We might have had a track from Deep Purple if I'd have thought hard enough about it. But instead, you've got one from
Simply Red.
You've got one from Pink Floyd instead. We've chosen any colour you like.
Absolutely.
Brilliant. Fantastic chat, Gareth.
I'll stop at that point. All right.
I know. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.